on today's Run to the Top podcast.
What I mostly noticed was that, like, your mind sort of turns everything you see into something else. So you see a rock and it looks like a house or a car or a tent. You see a stick on the ground and it looks like it's moving like a snake.
Welcome to the Run to the Top podcast from Runners Connect, where it's all about learning from the best and most inspiring minds in the sport. Together, we can train a smarter, healthier, and faster running community. Now here's your host, Stephanie K. Atwood.
Welcome. This is Stephanie K. Atwood, Boston Marathon qualifier, coach, and host for the Run to the Top podcast. On today's podcast, our guest and a personal friend of mine is Alan Carano, an avid trail runner who starts where most of us stop. Alan ran his first race ever, a 50K, in 2010. Since then, he has run a few more 50Ks, as well as the North Face 50 Miler in Marin, the Miwok 100K, and the Wasatch Front 100 Mile and Tahoe Rim 100 Mile trail races. And Alan is one of a handful of people who have attempted to run the entire John Muir Trail, a 211-mile section of the Pacific Crest Trail, unsupported and nonstop. A movie was made in 2016 of the crazies who have actually attempted this feat. Before we get to listen to more of Alan's story, let's pause for a brief word from one of our sponsors. This podcast is brought to you by NewKneeShop.com. Don't let knee pain keep you from completing your long runs or, worse, sideline you altogether. An innovative new product called New Knee can help. New Knee is designed specifically to relieve that dreaded runner's knee pain. Let New Knee help you get back to running without knee pain. Available today at NewKneeShop.com. That's N-U-N-E-E. shop.com. Use code RC20 for a 20% discount. That's RC20 for a 20% discount. Welcome back, everyone, and welcome to our guest, Alan Carano. Welcome, Alan.
Hi, welcome. Thanks. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's great for me to be interviewing you. I'm so impressed with what you've done and learned some new things from reading your bio. We always start the podcast with four basic questions. How old are you now? Where were you born? Where do you live now? And what is your favorite race distance or type of race?
Okay, so I'm 45 years old. I was born in Washington, D.C. and grew up in Maryland, and I currently live in El Cerrito, California, which is right near Berkeley, and I think my favorite race distance now, I'd have to say, is 100-mile distance.
That is so wild. Wow. Okay, well, we're going to go on to your getting to clarify some of this stuff that a lot of us just wonder even how anybody gets to running 100 miles. I know it's growing in popularity, but before you started running, you actually spent a good portion of your 20s and 30s rock climbing. So what made you change to ultra running?
There's a lot of factors that went into that. I think part of it is sort of the aging process. When you're in your 20s and 30s, I guess at least for me, I was a little more willing to take more risks and had less responsibilities and at work and family life and things like that. So I guess I was looking for a new challenge in a lot of ways, but also something that's a little less risky. You know, climbing, you can definitely manage the risk in a lot of ways, but there is always that that chance that you mess up on a given day and get seriously hurt or worse.
I didn't even know that you were a climber, Alan, because that the way you just explained that really is kind of what happened to me. I did a lot of climbing in my 20s and early 30s, and then the family thing, and just like you were saying, I mean, it really did happen that way. And running had always been part of my life, and so that just became a priority instead of kind of secondary to the climbing.
Right. And, there's other things involved, too. Living in the Bay Area, there's a lot of great climbing in Yosemite and in the Sierra, but it's a bit of a drive. You know, you're looking at 3 to 5 hour drive for a weekend of climbing each way. And the trail running is right here, like right out my door and over in Marin. There's much better access to trail running here than there is to climbing. So that's part of it as well.
Yeah, totally. It's way more convenient.
Yeah. And then also, you know, a number of my climbing partners had kind of started doing more running and gotten into ultra running. So there was a social aspect of that too. And it was just a new challenge. You know, I'd gotten to the point in climbing where I had done most of the things that I had wanted to do. And, you know, I felt like I wasn't really getting better, or I would have to put in a whole lot more time to get to be a better, stronger climber.
Yep.
And it was sort of just a natural transition to like pick up a new skill where the learning curve was, you know, much steeper and I was getting better faster. So,
yeah. Well, I can totally understand that personally as well as pragmatically. Now, your first official race ever was the Skyline to the Sea 50K.
Yeah.
What was that race like for you, and how did you do, you know, finish wise, and what did you learn from it?
I learned a lot from that one. It was a really fun race for the first half. And so, of course, I guess like everybody, I went out way too hard. Mm. I think my longest training run leading up to that was around 15 or 18 miles. And
wow.
So 50K is like 31 miles.
Yeah.
That's an overall downhill run, but there's definitely a lot of uphills on it too. There's probably 3,000 or 4,000 feet of gain on that. And so I just kind of pounded the downhills pretty hard, and I was smart enough to hike a lot of the uphills because I kind of realized that's what I had to do to finish it. But yeah, by the last 10 miles or so, I had to hike most of it because my legs were cramping up. And you know, I didn't know anything about taking in salts or, you know, I don't know. I think my body just wasn't ready for that kind of effort over that kind of mileage. So I blew up well before the finish.
Yeah, well, that's how you learn, though. That happened with me with my first marathon as well. You learn from doing that kind of thing. I've actually backpacked that Skyline to the Sea, so
yeah,
I know the course.
Right, and I actually backpacked it as well with my wife before doing this race, and so that was, it was just such a beautiful trail, and actually backpacking it, we found ourselves running certain, you know, a lot of the easier downhill sections.
Yeah.
And so that's actually what inspired me to run the race. It was like,
nice. Wow,
I could do this whole thing in a few hours and not carry anything.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful, and the running is super fun. Those trails are just amazingly smooth. And
beer at the end.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it was a great experience, even though it didn't go quite as well.
That's the way races are, especially when they're new distances, and especially if you're new to the whole field. So I know 50Ks weren't really enough for you, so you moved to 50 milers. And tell us about your first 50 miler.
The first 50 mile race I did was the North Face. I guess it's the North Face Endurance Challenge that they do in Marin every year. And it's a pretty big one. There's a lot of prize money in that. A lot of big names come to it. But it's also pretty cheap to get into compared to a lot of other races.
Mm-hmm.
And it's close. It's right in our backyard here. And the trails in Marin are beautiful. So that was kind of a natural for my first one. But I actually, before the race, I actually went out by myself and ran pretty much all of the course one day, sort of unsupported, or I think I had maybe stopped at the car once or twice. So I kind of did the race before the race, if that makes sense, just to see if I could do it.
And you were better prepared for that 50 miler than you were for your first 50K.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I think I had done at least one or two more 50Ks in between, and then, you know, a bunch of, you know, much, much more, you know, longer training runs and kind of much more regular weekly training that I wasn't really doing before. I was definitely in much better shape.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you actually what equipment you use now for your training runs and how does that change when you're racing? We're going to go into some of these ultra unsupported runs that you've done in a couple of questions, but now we're talking more racing and training runs. What kind of equipment do you use?
So for my training runs, what I bring really depends a lot on the distance that I'm planning to go or how long I think it's going to take. Mm-hmm. If it's under an hour, usually I won't really carry much of anything. Between like 1 to 2 hours, or even sometimes up to 2.5 or 3 hours, I'll bring up one bottle, like a hand bottle. I like the Ultimate Direction soft bottles are the ones I like to use, but really any of them work. Usually just maybe, you know, a gel or two or some shot blocks for food. And again, depending on the distance or time. And you know, you don't really need much to run. I mean, like I'll usually wear a hat, sunscreen, you know,
and right.
That's about it for the training runs. Sometimes I will wear a pack, but
talk about shoes.
Okay.
That's important for people, you know?
Yeah. So, I've tried a lot of different running shoes. Most of my running is trail running. So I have a closet full of trail shoes and only really one road shoe that I use on a regular basis. For the long distance trail runs, my absolute favorite is the Altra Olympus. I really like the extra cushioning and the sort of wider toe box that they give. They're not too stiff. They're not too soft. They just kind of work for me. I'm on my 7th or 8th pair of those, I think.
Wow.
And I use various other shoes as well. You know, if it's a super technical run, I might use something like the La Sportiva Akasha. I've used the Hoka Speed Goat 2s. Those work pretty well for me too. And then for road running, the Hoka Clifton 3 is my favorite. I've got like 3 pairs of those that I'm kind of working through. But I really, you know, if I have the chance to get out on the trails, that's what I do 90% of the time. So typically I only run on the roads either when it's too wet or too cold or, you know, I just can't access the trails.
Yeah. So. Which does happen in some kinds of weather.
Yeah, it definitely happens. But
not your first choice for training runs or for racing.
Yeah,
or
I mean, I guess I'm much more inspired by getting out on the trails and in the wilderness. So I like to train sort of specifically for that. I think the trails sort of beat up your body a little bit less than pavement too. Mm-hmm. So that's a factor. And you know, there's, you don't have to worry about cars and all that. So,
right.
But there is definitely some good, like the Nimitz, paved trail in Berkeley and the Berkeley Hills is kind of a go-to for me in the wintertime. So yeah, I'll do whatever it takes, but, if I have the choice, it's always going to be a trail.
Yeah. Now unaccompanied running is not a race and you've done a lot of unaccompanied, unsupported running. And talk about how you prepare in general for a self-sufficient, unaccompanied run. Because that's different. That's going to be different than a trail race.
Yeah, in a race, obviously you have aid stations and people kind of helping you fill up your bottles and giving you food or whatever you need. But yeah, most of my training runs and a lot of my sort of adventure runs are self or unsupported. So, you know, you got to think about how long you're going to be out there, how much food or how many calories you're going to need over that time period, how you're going to refill your water or, you know, if you need to bring all your water from the start. So all those factors kind of go into planning what you're going to carry and how big of a pack you need to fit it in. Do you need a water filter or do you just need to carry 2 or 3 liters of water in a camelback? And I find in the Sierras, I usually don't need to carry a whole lot of water because there's a lot of streams and rivers and lakes and things to fill from. So usually either just bring a small filter or a or sometimes just, just drink the water if it seems like it's in a safe enough area. But I guess they don't recommend that.
Do you do your training runs with poles?
Often I do, yeah. If it's going to be a significant amount of elevation gain, yeah, I'll usually bring poles, unless I'm training for a race that's where they don't allow poles. But most of these mountain races do. So, yeah, I really like poles and I use them quite a bit.
And what brand do you use, or what type do you use? Because I'm sure the weight is something that is important for runners.
Yeah, I like the Black Diamond carbon Z poles. I forget what they actually call the model. It's basically the lightest one they make, mm-hmm. And they fold down pretty small. And I think they weigh about 8 ounces or something. You can fold them up and put them in your pack, or just carry them, and you notice them, but they're pretty unobtrusive. And I find they really help on both the uphills and some of the steeper downhills too.
It sounds like there's a lot of planning involved in these longer runs. And I know you said in your bio that you love running in the Sierra, running in the mountains, doing these fairly long runs that are unaccompanied and are not necessarily races. Talk about some of the routes that you've done. And I know some of those have been fastest known times. You've accomplished those. And that's a new term, FKT. But talk about some of those routes that you've done and what they're like in terms of elevation and beauty and where they are. This is really a new phase of running that I think, you're one of the pioneers in, to be honest.
Sure. I'm not sure I would call myself a pioneer, but it's kind of a new phenomenon, or at least it's definitely grown in popularity quite a bit in the last few years. But people have been out there, under the radar, I think, doing some pretty amazing things. And this guy, Peter Backwin, has kind of been keeping track of it on his website for quite a few years now. I'm not sure when it started, but I think it goes back to at least the 90s.
Wow.
And actually, Peter Backwin and Buzz Burrell were, I think, they kind of came up with the concept of FKT. And goes back to when they actually were trying to do the John Muir Trail in the fastest time that they basically had to figure out, okay, what is the fastest time that's been done, because there wasn't anywhere to look that up.
Yeah,
and so they came up with this idea of fastest known time, because we don't really know if someone else did it and didn't tell anybody.
Totally.
So, and actually the film that I made, they were both in the film kind of talking about that concept and how they came up with the idea, and then their trip that they did, it was sometime in the 90s, they did the JMT in 4 or 5 days.
Well, let's move into that, because you are talking now about the John Muir Trail, 211 miles, I looked it up today, of High Sierra Trail. There's a lot of details that are beyond just that it's 211 miles and that it's High Sierra. And go into, some of the details of your experiences with it, how you got involved in it, how it started historically. That's a really interesting concept, that, my gosh, I mean, people could have been doing that for a long time.
So, I first hiked most of the John Muir Trail in 2011 with my wife, Amy. And, I was sort of aware at the time that this guy, Brett Moen, had done it in a couple of years before in 2009 in like 3 days and 18 hours or something like that. And, mm-hmm. Most people take between 2 to 4 weeks on the JMT. It's like you said, it's 211 miles and it's 221 if you count like getting out from Mount Whitney back to the road.
Okay.
So, that was kind of mind blowing to think, like, we were out there for, I think, 10 days and we did a section of about 180 miles of it. So we're doing about 18 miles a day.
Yeah.
And just thinking like, wow, like some guy did this in like basically 3.5 days. And like, it was just sort of mind blowing.
Yeah. But it
got me thinking like, well, maybe I could like come back and do this in a week. Like maybe that would be feasible.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of took over in my mind, and I couldn't let go of that thought. And part of it was because the trail is just so incredibly beautiful that, like, I wanted to go back and, like, just spend more time out there. And I also have a bit of a kind of competitive drive, and, you know, athleticism was a big part of my life. So it just kind of all congealed into this idea of, like, well, I'm going to just come back and give it a try next year.
Uh-huh.
And so I did. The following year in 2012, I hiked the whole JMT from Yosemite to Mount Whitney in just under a week, like 6 days and 18 hours.
Oh,
and that's
okay.
Still 3 days longer than it took Brett.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, and he's an incredible athlete. But when he did that, it kind of blew everybody away. And a lot of people didn't believe it at the time because it was just such a huge achievement. So after doing that, I was like, wow, that was hard, but, like, I could probably go quite a bit faster. I don't know if I'll be able to ever do, you know, 3.5 days, but I could probably do 4 or 5 days, and, like, why not just see what I can do?
You know, so I started training. Were you going from north to south, or were you going from south to north at that point?
No. So the first two times, so the one with my wife, and then the next year when I did the whole trail in a week, we were going from north to south. So starting in Yosemite or Tuolumne, and then heading towards Whitney.
And that's a little bit easier, right? I mean, that just...
It's actually... Well, it depends.
Okay.
So easier in this sense, like, there's sort of pros and cons both ways.
Uh-huh.
What makes it easier for most people to go from north to south is that you start at a lower elevation in Yosemite, and you sort of gradually get acclimated as you go, and then the highest elevation passes, and Mount Whitney, which is 14,500 feet roughly, is at the very end of the trail. So you're sort of gradually getting higher and higher as you go, and you keep going back down into these valleys and then back up over a pass. But it's sort of going from low to high, which works really well physiologically, especially when you have 2 to 4 weeks to do that.
Right.
But on the other hand, most of the people that have done or tried to do an FKT on the John Muir Trail tend to start from the Mount Whitney end and go from south to north towards Yosemite. And the reason for that is that you basically climb all the way up Mount Whitney in, like, 3 to 4 hours on your first morning and get the hardest, you know, this huge chunk of elevation done. And then it's sort of downhill from there, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And so as your body is deteriorating, your elevation or your average elevation is going down. So it sort of gets easier as you go from that standpoint.
Yeah, and that was one of the points you brought up in the movie, talking about the nutrition and the deterioration of your body. If you're trying to run that far with even though I know you take rest periods, you're not sleeping a full period of time. And so part of what you said you learned was that it was good to, you know, to be physiologically more demanding in the beginning, because then at the end with your whole situation deteriorating, then there's more opportunity to be able to finish.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, most of the sleep breaks on, you know, on these FKT attempts, I think people tend to plan for, like, maybe 2 to 3 sleep breaks of 3 to 4 hours at a time. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't always work out that way. Yeah. I mean, I think most people plan on, like, three nights of sleep, but each night is going to be like 3 to 4 hours. And a couple people have sort of skipped the last one and just gone through that second or that last night, which is really difficult, especially when you've only had a few hours of sleep combined over the last two nights.
And you're running like 70 to 80 miles a day, and it ain't flat.
Yeah. You're doing about 70 miles a day, I guess 60 to 70, depending how you break up the days. But, and the elevation gain, I think the total gain over the entire trail is around 38,000 if you go from south to north, 38,000 feet. And it's more if you go the other way. It's more like 46 or 42 or something if you go from north to south.
Wow. Now, how many times did you attempt it? And you didn't come out as a fastest known time, but you also didn't complete it every time. Did you complete it at least one time?
So the only time I actually completed the entire trail was that time in 2012 when it was like 6 days and 18 hours. So no, I've tried, aside from that trip, I've tried actually a total of four other times. And so in 2013, 2014, and then twice in 2015.
Wow.
And, so the first two, well, the first time I was really more of a trial run just to see like what it was like. And it was in October, so it was really late. And, I had a lot of reasons why it wasn't likely to be successful, but I just kind of figured I'd give it a shot anyway. And so that one only lasted like a day. And I said, I'm nowhere near ready for this, and bailed. The second time was in 2014. And I made it quite a bit further that time, probably about halfway to the Bishop Pass turnoff. And basically there was a big storm that was coming in, and I had to decide if I was going to keep going or bail. And it just looked like it was going to be a really bad storm, which it turned out to be. And, so I made the right call and just exited at Bishop Pass.
That was pretty disappointing.
Yeah. Wow. It was very disappointing, but you know, there's a pretty pretty minimal gear that I was carrying and that most people are carrying on these trips, like there's a fine line between, you know, being safe enough being safe and not being safe. And so when you have a big storm coming in, like it's going to slow you down. So you're probably not going to have any real chance at the FKT anyway. So it just makes sense to kind of call it at that point and get out while you can without risking, you know, hypothermia and all that.
Yeah. Risking your life really. So, okay. That's two times. There were two more times.
Yeah. And so then in 2015, I actually was able to train quite a bit more and having a little more experience doing this kind of thing and talking to some other people that were also doing the same thing and kind of training with them. And so I thought I had a pretty good chance in 2015. And I actually made it about, I think it was 175 miles in 65 hours.
Uh-huh.
So I was maybe, you know, it was going to be close. I may, you know, the last day is really always the kicker. And you never really know how anybody's trip is really going to end up until that last day.
Mm-hmm.
But I was able to put myself in position to at least have a chance on the last day. But I didn't get enough sleep. I think I slept a total of 3 hours over the first two nights. And that third night, I got pretty loopy and got lost and just kind of lost the ability to make good decisions and sort of route finding issues. And I made some other mistakes, like not bringing a map because I thought I knew the trail well enough that I didn't need it. But it turns out when I'm very sleep deprived, I forget things. So things that were very familiar before were no longer familiar in the dark. So that didn't end well. But I came back, I guess about 6 weeks later and tried again. And, I definitely would have finished and I would have been really close to an FKT on that trip. But again, I had a big storm come in and just ended up making the call at Red's Meadow that it wasn't really safe to continue in the state that I was in with the weather the way it was. So I ended up having to call it there.
Well, you had it together enough to be able to make that call, because that's got to be a really tough one.
Yeah, it is. And it wasn't as hard as maybe you might think. I definitely put a lot of effort and training and whatnot into these things. But in the end, I try to make conservative decisions. And that's sort of, I think that's what kept me alive and pretty much uninjured throughout all the climbing I did. And so I carries over into this stuff too. I think it's always more important to come home and in one piece, and it'll always be there if you want to go back for it.
Yeah, that's true. I'm sure motivation wise, it's difficult to stay motivated for something like that. But I know you're pretty driven. I did want to ask you about the movie that was your idea, and really fascinating movie. And I hope you'll give us a link or something at the end of this interview so people can maybe see that, or at least get to where it's being shown. One of the things in the movie was talking about these hallucinations, and everybody was talking about that. Can you talk about that a little bit from your own experience, and then also talk about how the movie came about and you know, a little bit more about what it involves?
So the hallucinations, yeah, I think everybody finds that kind of fascinating. And that was actually one of the things that I found fascinating before going through it. So reading Brett Moen's trip reports, he talked about that quite a bit. And he was one of those, he actually on his trip in 2009 overslept on his first night. And so in order to make up that time, he decided to not sleep on his last night, basically. Uh-huh. Just went through two nights in a row, I think.
Wow.
So he was having some pretty severe sleep deprivation and hallucinations. For me, what it was, what I mostly noticed was that, like, your mind sort of turns everything you see into something else. Mm-hmm. So you see a rock and it looks like a house or a car or a tent. And you see a tree and it looks like a person or an animal. You see a stick on the ground and it looks like it's moving, like a snake. So it's like, it wasn't like huge, like crazy hallucinations like you might imagine if you're like taking mushrooms or something. I mean, I've never done that, but I imagine it gets kind of wacky. But it was more just like your eyes sort of play tricks on you and everything looks like something else. And so you, every time you come around a corner, you think you see a tent, but it's really just a rock. Or you think it's a car, and you're out in the middle of nowhere in the wilderness. There's no cars.
So is there this kind of this message going back and forth in your brain that, no, that's not really what I'm seeing, but it sure looks like that's what I'm seeing, and so I just need to stay on the course?
Yeah, and part of it is, like, as you get closer, it sort of becomes a little more clear, and then you realize, oh, yeah, that's just a rock.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, there's a lot of that, like, having to rethink, like, the visual information that you're getting, that, like, naturally everything is just sort of what you see is what it is. But you're having to question everything that you see because it's really not what you think it is. So it's a little confusing. And your brain is in this big fog anyway. And, like, for me at least, my balance starts to get weird.
Mm.
Like, I start to get really glad that I have poles. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. When, you know, after 36 or 40 or however many hours, like, every time I stop, I would find myself kind of, like, moving around, like, having a hard time standing without, like, leaning on something. So, yeah. And then, like, I would, like, if you turn your head too quickly, like, it's like the room is spinning sensation, except it's not a room, it's just everything.
Oh.
So, like, your things like, you have to do everything a little bit more slowly. And then, you know, of course, it's in the daytime, it's all not so bad. But in the dark, you know, you're using a headlamp, you can only see this, like, little tunnel of light where your headlamp is shining. So every time you turn your head, your visual field changes dramatically because your light moved to something else. And so that gets really confusing for your brain when your brain is really tired. So there's a lot of things you might not think about that kind of all at the same time sort of start to deteriorate mentally. And then at the same time, you're completely physically exhausted too.
Indeed. Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun, actually.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Now, talk about what was the reason for creating this movie and a little bit of the detail about what the movie includes, because it's a great movie. I loved watching it.
Well, thank you. It was I really appreciate that. It seems like the people that have seen it, we've gotten really good feedback, and everybody really seems to enjoy it. So I'm happy about that.
Yeah.
I guess I was inspired to make the film because a friend of mine had, an old climbing partner of mine named Jeremy Collins, who's also an artist, and he has his own clothing company now called Meridian Lion. A few years ago, I think it was in 2013 or 14, he created a film about his climbing adventures combined with his art that was called Drawn. And he got it, he entered it in a bunch of film festivals and he won some awards. And so I was sort of inspired by his film and how he was able to go from like not knowing anything about film to just making this really, really well done film that everybody really enjoyed, and told this kind of a unique story about his climbing and his art and how they sort of came together. And it was just a really inspiring work that he did.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the same time, I was really obsessed with this John Muir Trail FKT project that I'd been working on for a while. And I had been reading other people's trip reports and just kind of realized like there's a lot of people out there, including Brett Moen and, you know, Peter Backlin and Katja Corbett and Amber Monforte and all these people that have done the JMT in this sort of FKT style, putting themselves through these crazy experiences. They all have like pretty crazy, amazing stories to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody else in the world knows about this. This is just this tiny little community in like some weird corner of the internet.
Right.
And there's like, you know, maybe 50 people reading these trip reports.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
But I just thought, wow, these are great stories. Somebody should make a film and like interview these people and let them tell their stories, mm-hmm. and then get some trail footage and kind of show what it's like actually doing it. And so I just did it.
It's a pretty crazy movie, and I'm so glad you did it, because I think that's as close as I will ever get to trying to get an FKT.
Right.
But I loved it.
And I have to say, I never would have been able to make this film by myself. I know nothing about film. I know, you know, I don't even have a video camera except for my phone, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But I was able to get in touch with this guy, Jason Fitzpatrick, who made another really cool film about the John Muir Trail a few years back that I really enjoyed. And I met him through my friend Jeremy, and I just asked him, like, hey, would you be interested in doing this project? It's like kind of a crazy idea I have, but, you know, I can't do it by myself. Do you want to help? And he's like, sure, let's do it.
Wow.
And he's probably really sorry now that he ever said that, because it took like 3 years to get this thing done.
Wow.
But it turned out really good. And I think we're both really happy with how it came out. So.
It turned out really good. And you should be, and he also should be very proud of what you've created. And I highly recommend that people get a chance to look at it. I don't know how available it is to the general masses. Can you tell me a little bit about the scheduling?
Yeah, sure. So it's not available online yet. I think the plan is for early next year or possibly late fall.
And the title is Unsupported, right?
Right. It's okay. Called Unsupported. And it basically follows me and three or four other people doing their own unsupported trips on the JMT, all trying to break an FKT. And then it has interviews with some other people that we weren't able to get actual trail footage from, mm-hmm. but who've also done the same thing. So it's only 20 minutes long, and it's I think it gives you a good synopsis and kind of a good feeling for what it's like, but definitely you can't fit 78 hours of trail into a 20-minute film. So
no, but you did it. It's a great story. And so when is it available?
Right. So we've had a few showings already. There's I think the next one that's definite is planned for December 1st, and it's in the LA area. I don't know exactly where, but it will be announced on Facebook and probably various other places, Instagram and stuff as well. Jason Fitzpatrick is setting that up. No, actually, I think it's going to be part of the Switchback Showcase.
Okay.
Which is, so that's going to include, I think, two or three other films, all hiking and backpacking related. Mm-hmm. One on the High Sierra Trail, and then another film that Jason made up in Alaska, basically a river canoeing trip up in Alaska that he did with a couple older guys that he actually met on the JMT. So, but anyway, it'll be three or four films all in one show. And that's what we did for the premiere a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. And they did another one up in Sacramento a week or two ago. And so there may be more than one more of those, but at least one on December 1st down in the LA area. So check out Jason Fitzpatrick or the Muir Project's Facebook page or my Facebook page, which is just Alan Allen. And there'll be announcements on there for that. As far as online release, like I said, I think that'll be early next year, possibly late fall. We also are hoping it's going to get into the Trail Running Film Festival up in Seattle, but we're not sure at this point.
Yay. I'll keep my fingers crossed.
So we'll see. It'll definitely go online for the general public at some point. Mm-hmm. Because of the festival requirements, you can't do that until after the festivals have already happened. So,
Gotcha. Okay. Well, we are actually getting close to the end of our time here. And I wanted to kind of summarize things. You talk about how much you enjoy running, not necessarily racing, especially in the mountains. And how important is this to your life today and what's going to be in the future for you?
Yeah, it's super important to me. It's a big part of what gives my life meaning and I get a lot of joy and satisfaction out of it. I definitely, you know, I enjoy the racing. I enjoy the FKT stuff as well, although it's definitely not always fun. But I really enjoy just getting out there and being in the mountains and, you know, just running up to Half Dome or Clouds Rest or doing a big loop in the Sierra or even just in Marin or the local trails here. It's a huge part of my life. I probably run 5 to 6 days a week on average. And, you know, I haven't been able to get out as much this summer as I would have liked to for various reasons, but I did get a good 100-mile race in and a good long training weekend up in the Tahoe area before that. So yeah, it's definitely hugely important to me, and it's something I'm going to continue doing as long as I can, you know, hopefully into my 70s or longer. I know there's a lot of old ultra runners who are still doing it at 70 and beyond. So hopefully I'll be one of those too.
Yeah, I think that's a really important way to look at it.
Yeah, but you know, whether I'm running or hiking or even just hanging out by a lake, that's, you know, if I'll do what I can do.
Right.
And so when I can't run anymore, I'll hike. And, you know, I guess at some point you spend more time sitting around and looking at the sunset and enjoying the lake than the hike. But you know, just getting out there, that's the important thing for me.
Yeah, so. I agree. And the mountains are such a spiritual high.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As far as what's coming up for me, I'd love to give the JMT another run.
Right.
It doesn't look like this year it's going to work out time wise, but I kind of always keep that on the back burner if situation and conditions and weather and everything line up. You know, I could probably make another go at it. If not this year, then maybe next year.
I'll keep my fingers crossed. And of course, you have to deal with weather, but you also have to deal with fires now. I know
the fires are getting worse and worse every year, you know, so it's like, it's almost better to go in September or October now because the fire season's sort of winding down at that point, but then the days are getting shorter and there's, you know, so there's a lot of things to think about.
Oh.
It's colder. But yeah, last year, Francois Dehaene, this French ultra runner, did the JMT in like 2 days and 19 hours last year in October. So, and he was fully supported. He had, you know, pacers and crew and everything else. So he's solemn and sponsored, you know, he's big time.
Yeah.
But we're well under 3 days, which had never been done before. And you did it in October. So it's definitely possible if you get the right weather and things line up right.
Yeah. Well, and what you said about being supported versus unsupported is a huge difference, but whether the one or the other, you still have to have the weather and you know, all the other pieces working for you as well.
Right. Yeah. Right. As far as future plans, I definitely would like to do more off trail, hiking and, you know, you can't run a whole lot off the trails, but you can do some running, but doing things like the High Sierra or the Sierra High Route, which is mostly off trail, and the California 14ers, you know, there's a lot of that stuff to be done too. That's a little more adventurous than, you know, just staying on the trail. So there's always a lot of possibilities, and I'd like to kind of keep things fresh and you know, not get stuck in the same old rut all the time too. So.
Sounds good. Well, you're invited to come to Mexico because things will be fresher too.
All right. That sounds fun. I'd
love to. Some new trails down here.
I hear there's some good ones.
Well, we are going to be moving on here. We're running out of time. We're going to pause for a brief message from one of our sponsors, and when we come back, we'll be moving into the final kick. Have you been struggling with knee pain on your runs? Don't let dreaded runner's knee derail your training and stop you from getting to the starting line. New Knee is an innovative new product designed specifically for runner's knee. It can get you running again immediately without knee pain. New Knee was invented by two-time Ironman Mike Emmerle because of his own 5-year struggle with runner's knee. Mike had tried a variety of treatments, including compression sleeves and knee straps. Nothing allowed him to run without knee pain. Frustrated, Mike came up with his own unique solution, a solution based upon research. The research reveals that if you relieve the pressure, you relieve the pain. New Knee does exactly that. By relieving the pressure on your patella, your kneecap, New Knee can provide immediate relief of runner's knee pain. Mike now trains pain-free and no longer modifies his training to accommodate knee pain. Today, Mike receives weekly emails from runners like Sarah, who said, "It's wonderful. I'm back to running and couldn't be happier." And Andy, who said, "Congratulations on a winning design. New Knee helped me immediately." New Knee has even been 5-star rated by DPT and running injury specialist Dr. Ben Shadow. Every now and then, an innovative product comes along that changes everything. New Knee is changing how runner's knee pain is treated. Stop runner's knee in its tracks by going to newkneeshop.com and use code RC20 for a 20% discount. That's NUNEESHOP, newkneeshop.com, and use code RC20. Support for Run to the Top comes from Flavanaturals, a recently launched brand of chocolate and cocoa powder with 5 to 9 times the cocoa flavanol antioxidants of a typical dark chocolate bar. These increased levels are shown to support exercise performance, brain function, and heart health. This is achieved by starting with some of the highest antioxidant cocoa beans in the world and preserving flavanols using all natural preparation. FlavaBar chocolate bars and FlavaMix cocoa powder are perfect for pre- or post-workout, increasing circulation and the amount of oxygen and nutrients delivered to fatigued muscles. And equally important, FlavaBars and FlavaMix taste amazing. The FlavaNatural coffee bar has become a favorite pre-long run snack. The caffeine gets your mind awake, and the flavanols help increase blood flow, which are both really needed before those early morning runs or when starting a long run after an exhausting day at work. We've put together an awesome 20% discount for you so you can try them yourself. Just go to flavanaturals.com and enter discount code RTTT for the 20% off your next order. That's F as in Fred, L as in love, A as in apple, V as in Victor, A as in apple, FlavaNaturals.com, and discount code RTTT. Okay, welcome back with Alan. I've got the wrong name here in my notes, Alan Carano. It was the wrong name in my notes. I'm going, oh, that's not who I'm talking to. I'm Ultra Runner, and me, your host, Stephanie K. Atwood. Alan, are you ready for the final kick?
Yes.
All right. Question number one is, what is your favorite local training run? And tell us enough that our readers could find it if they come to your area. Where to park, name of the starting point, how long, terrain, safety issues, etc.
Okay. So I guess my favorite sort of classic local trail run is it's in the Berkeley Hills in Tilden Park. So it starts, there's actually a few places you can start. It's a big loop that I like to do, but, right off of Cannon Drive, which is, one of the entrances into Tilden. And you can park right there. There's a little pull out on the side of the road that you can park at, right as you drive down into Tilden before you get to, the main, like Lone Oak and the little farm area. Mm-hmm. So you park there on the road, run down the Pack Rat Trail, which is a nice, easy, smooth downhill to Jewel Lake, and take a right on the Loop Road and follow that to Meadows Canyon Trail, and that winds up to the Seaview Trail, which is pretty steep. So you get a lot of elevation gain going all the way up Vollmer Peak on the Seaview Trail. And then come down the Vollmer Peak Trail to Grizzly Peak. And Grizzly Peak is some really fun single track downhill, not too steep, but just kind of nice and windy and flowy. And then that takes you to the Selby Trail, which brings you right back to where you started.
Sounds good.
Comes out to about 11 and a half miles or so. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely ways you could make it shorter or longer if you need to. Probably anywhere from, I think you could do 9.5 or so, or you can extend it out as long as you want. There's so many trails in Tilden, but yeah, it's, I think, about 2,000 feet of elevation gain and loss in about 11.5 miles, and that's one of my favorites.
Nice. And there's some pretty good maps, topo maps of Tilden Park. You can look those up online. So that's an easy way to kind of check it out ahead of time and get some of the sense of what the trails are like, and also just get, something that's printed for you when you go out there.
Right. You can map it out on Strava too. So cool. There's a lot of ways to do it.
Okay, we're moving on. Question two here. Your favorite or recommended running book? Can be fiction, nonfiction, whatever.
I think for me it was Brian Powell's book. It's sort of an ultra running how to get started manual, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's called something like Relentless Forward Progress.
Okay.
I might not be getting it exactly right, but I'm pretty sure that's it. Yeah, I think it's Relentless Forward Progress by Brian Powell. He runs the I Run Far website.
Oh, okay.
With his wife. Uh-huh. So it's a good, pretty accessible book for somebody that's like, wanting to do their first ultra or their first 50 miler or first 100 miler, kind of how to train, how to, all the different things to watch out for, these are the mistakes you don't want to make, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so, right.
And it just has a great title too.
Good. Okay. Word of wisdom or advice or humor? Anything you want to share in that way?
I think the biggest thing for me is don't go out too hard. Start out slow, save something for the end.
Good point.
And that's in these longer races, that just becomes so important.
I know. And we didn't really get a chance to talk about you and your 100-mile runs and races, but you've done a few of those, and I'm sure that advice is well heeded, and you've had a chance to test it out.
Yeah, the last one I did, the TRT, I actually finished 10th, and I think at the beginning of the race, I was up in the, the top 10 in the very beginning, but I sort of, eased off a little bit, mm-hmm. and let people pass me, mm-hmm. and I was probably running between 15th and 20th for most of the race, but I was able to finish really strong.
Nice.
And work my way back up to 10th. So that felt really good.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Is there someone or some subject about running that you would like to listen to in a future podcast on Run to the Top?
I guess I'm kind of biased, but I like the ultra running perspective. I'd love to hear, you know, more from people that, you know, the FKT people, like, you know, Brett Moen, and there's a guy who just actually did the JMT, this guy named Sean Ranney. I think he'd be a really interesting guy to talk to. He just did it in like 3 minutes slower than Brett's time from 2000, which is actually no longer the FKT. Another guy named Andrew Bentz broke it a few years ago by a few hours, but. Anyway, Sean is like in his 40s. The guy with the FKT is in his 20s. Uh-huh. So I feel like a little connection with Sean.
Indeed.
Because I feel like I know what he went through out there a little bit. Anyway. So he'd be a fun person to talk to.
Okay. Well, those are possibilities. I love getting these names because then it gives me people to contact. Okay. So we are actually at the point where I want you to give us contact information, how our audience can follow your progress and also, learn about what's going on with Ultra Running, the movie especially, and you, if you're as much information as you're willing to share about you or things that you're interested in this Ultra Running world.
Okay.
Give us that information now.
Okay. So I'm pretty active on Facebook, and so you can connect up with me there if you want. My Facebook name is just Alan Allen. I don't know. I did that years ago when I was, because of my job, I didn't want to use my real last name. So I think about changing it back. But anyway, it's just Alan Allen on Facebook. Allen is the spelling of my first name. And so just do that twice. Allen, Allen.
Okay.
And then Jason Fitzpatrick on Facebook, he has his personal page, but also the Muir Project, which is his sort of film page. So that would probably be the better one to get info about the film. So just follow the Muir Project on Facebook. He's also on Instagram under the same name. And then I do have a blog, which I really don't update very often. I think it's actually been almost a year, so I should get on that. But my blog is called Never Doing That Again at Blogspot, which I'll let you see if you can figure out why. But so Never Doing That Again at Blogspot.com. And you can, there's a little link there if you want to email me. You can send a note there if you want. And I think that's about it. I'm not super active on, I have an Instagram account, but I don't really ever use it. So either Facebook or the blog is probably the best way.
That sounds like enough. And now I'm going to put in a little plug for REI because you work at REI in Berkeley. So if anybody shows up at the REI store in Berkeley and they ask for Alan, there's at least a good chance that you might be there and they could say hello in person.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, definitely feel free to come in and ask for me. I'm generally working back in the footwear area, so feel free to pop on in.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Alan, for doing this today.
All right. Thank you, Stephanie. It's been fun.
And thank you, our audience, for joining us for today's podcast at Run to the Top. Follow us at Runners Connect Winners Circle on Facebook by going to runnersconnect.net/FB. And please subscribe to Run to the Top podcast at runnersconnect.net or on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, etc. You'll be notified every week when the new episode is published. Alan Carano, you have an interesting running life for sure. Wishing you uninjured training and many more miles to come. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
All right. Thank you. And I wish you the same. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with another great talk to entertain, educate, and inspire you as you head out on your running workout. This is Stephanie K. Atwood, your host with Run to the Top. Have a great one.
Thanks for listening to the Run to the Top podcast from runnersconnect.net.